There we go. So I am Corey Huff, from founder of theabundantartist.com, and this is a discussion about art and money with me and Jenny Gao. Jenny wrote a guest post for us on the blog a couple of weeks ago about art and leadership, the way that artists need to take leadership over their careers, and artists can band together as a group to take more control over our careers as artists and what happens to us in artistic pursuits. So today is the first part of a three-part series where we're going to talk about the various aspects of being a leader as an artist and how that ties in with making a living from your work and different things like that. And today, in today's session, we're going to talk about the relationship between art and money. So if you have questions or thoughts, hello, Iris, about the relationship between art and money, feel free to chime in with your questions there in the questions section here in the GoToMeeting. And if we have questions that we want to elaborate on, Jenny and I will answer those. And we also may unmute you and have you elaborate on some of your questions and sort of virtually bring you on the stage here to talk about some of your questions. So Jenny, thanks so much for being here with us. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourselves and introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Well, hi, everyone. I'm Jenny Gao, and I'm currently based out of Madison, Wisconsin. A little bit about my background. I've been doing art professionally for several years, made the decision about a year ago to pursue it full-time, and before that I was working on the corporate career track and doing project management, waste reduction, and just a lot of the things that I've seen in my work history, gone from working in education and nonprofit to working on the commercial side of things, and everywhere I went, I saw the same kind of patterns as far as what limited workplaces, what happened in the work culture, and also just like the role of creativity in the kind of problem solving that we need in our organizations today, and everything really just it kept tying back to what I wanted to do professionally as an artist. And so it was about a year ago that I said, yeah, this is something that I need to make front and center and really get to the core of to feed all other areas of my life professionally, which is what brought me to where we are today, having this conversation and about what the role of art is in leadership and today's topic in the role of art and its relationship with money.
Excellent. So, yeah. Excellent. Thank you so much. And Jenny, I should also mention a few months ago, you wrote a blog post about the myth of the starving artist that got a lot of shares and a lot of attention on Facebook and other social media. Can you just tell us a little bit about that post and how, because that was how you and I ended up meeting. Tell us a little bit about that post and what happened there.
Sure. Okay, yeah. So the premise of the post is that I start off talking about what happens when people ask me what I do. And this is a very typical question. This is small talk. Everywhere. So it's just, you know, that small talk you say, especially just, like, what do you do? That's what people want to know. And so when I say, well, I'm an artist, it takes people back a little bit. And of course, the question is always, in for a living, and I'm sure anyone in a creative career can relate to that. And so if I were to justify it by saying, well, you know, I consult as well for my previous career expertise, and suddenly this validated what I was doing. And so basically what I talk about in this post is, you know, how did we get here? How do we get to this place where when I answer this question, what do I do? It seems more valid to say something like, well, you know, I consult or I advise over this is what I actually do, this is what I make. And it's not, what I talk about in this post is it's not so much a matter of whether you create artwork or whether what you create is something else, but the fact that somehow culturally we've gotten to this place where we associate this question, what we do, with purely how we make a living.
Mm-hmm.
Whether and just, you know, and we've gotten away from the artistry of it, the creativity of it. We've gotten away from why we really want to do this. And that seemed to really resonate with people, and so it did get a lot of responses on social media. I got a lot of comments, and I got emails following up on it. And yeah, that was essentially what brought us into conversation with each other, because I know that this is a topic that you've explored a lot as well, Corey, on your blog, and just, you know, this idea that starving artist is, it's kind of a myth, but it's also kind of not in the sense that, and this is what I talked about in that post too, it's just it's a myth that we've chosen to believe in, and what we choose to believe in becomes the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
so the starving artist myth, this is a story that I have shared frequently on my blog and in talks that I give in person and lessons and stuff. There's a guy named Henry Murger, and I don't know how you would say his name in French. It's probably Henri or something like that. And he lived in the early 1800s in Paris, and he was a struggling bohemian. He was a struggling writer. He lived in the student district in Paris, and all of his friends were young, struggling students and stuff. And a lot of them were bohemians. They were actual ethnic bohemians who had moved into Paris and were struggling to make a living. And it was funny because in his book, he lionizes his artistic friends, the painters and sculptors and writers and stuff. And he makes them in the book. They are these amazing people who are like unto gods and Shakespeare and the Greek poets and stuff. But the funny thing is in the books, these artists or these would-be artists, none of them actually did any work. They all sat around and talked about
how,
they all sat around and talked about how nobody took them seriously as artists, but nowhere in the book did any of them actually like practice or show their work to anybody or anything like that. And the book, it's called A Day in the Life of the Bohemian. The book was a huge hit, right? It was very popular among the French aristocracy to the point that people who had read the book and their friends would dress up like bohemians and slum it down, down in the student district with the bohemians so that they could be cool. And the book went on to inspire this play called A Day in the Life of the Bohemian, and which went on to inspire Puccini's opera, La Boheme, and which, of course, was the inspiration for the musical Rent. So there's all of this cultural, all these cultural echoes from Murger's book. And people look at this and say, oh, well, you know, the artist who sits around and doesn't do anything is the thing that we should aspire to and the thing that we give a lot of attention to.
Yeah. It's, you know, so it's funny that you bring that up because that, yeah, so there's the image of the bohemian, and then one of the things that I found interesting, you read about any individual artist who's a part of this movement, right? Like Picasso, you know, he's one of the most iconic ones. But where it wasn't even so much this, like, so the idea is that, or the image is that they sit around, they don't do anything. But really the motive was that they wanted to separate work from money. They didn't want to work for money. They wanted to work for passion. They wanted to work for love. And it was, what was it? There was a quote from that book that inspiration rises early in the morning. And so that's what they did. They rise early in the morning and they paint. They paint all day long until the evening. And then the evening time is exclusively for fun, exclusively for going out in old Paris and in new Paris and in enjoying the luxury. And so in that, but then, you know, that's probably the part of the story that gets more of the dramatization. But yeah, it's just, I mean, I'm sure that any of us have heard that before too, and that's the thing that's become really, I think, the mainstay from that is, you know, it's the idea of working for passion rather than for a livelihood. Well, more specifically for the money itself, and the thing is, if you dig a little bit deeper, the thing that they were rejecting, was this idea that you're pursuing this thing that's corrupt, you know, like with capitalistic greed. You've got a lot of people during this time period who were very against what was happening with the capitalistic culture and with the consumer culture. And that's so much of what's still true of art movements today. With, you know, one of the things that we discussed before is protest art, and you talk about that's for political or social movement.
I just want to unpack that a second. So
sure.
You brought up protest art, and you brought up some famous artists' well documented railings against capitalism and against money. Do you think that there is a difference or a disparity between the artists who, like, art that is made specifically to rail against capitalist systems or specifically made to express specific political points, and art that is made for the purpose of that sort of art sort of turns money away, right? Whereas other kinds of art are more lend themselves better to making money. So when you say it doesn't. Yeah, sellability. So when you say it does and it doesn't, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that, like, I think there is this idea of what kind of art is sellable. I think you probably know this too. Well, it depends. It depends on who the customer is. The same person who's going to buy a political poster might not be the same person who wants a portrait of their pet or, you know, their kid, or it might be. I think one of the dangers, at least that I've seen as far as the association between art and money and the confusion around it, the tension around it with artists, is that, you know, for you to gain from it, that automatically means that you're selling out, or you have to make a particular type of work that sells out. But the artists who chose to rebel in this way, to say that they're not creating this work in pursuit of money, they're rebelling at the root to what corruption happened because of money. I mean, money, like any other technology, it's a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be used for good or evil. And this may be one of the ways in which artists have cut themselves at the knees a lot of times, where, we've emancipated ourselves to our own demise. You know, you've freed yourself from this tool, which means you've also freed yourself from the power that it can give you. And part of what we see with that, too, I mean, you think about, like the arguments that, there are particular types of art that aren't sellable. You look at the music industry. Look at some of the top songs. I mean, you just recently had something like, you know, Lady Gaga making songs that are protesting for women's issues, and Beyonce with her most recent piece, and just all the upheaval, you know, all the applause and the criticism surrounding it. You know, these are extremely political pieces that are getting a lot of heat, not just because of what they're talking about politically, but because they are in this monetary structure where now it's confusing, because there are some big companies that are profiting off of these really big movements that people are very emotionally charged by.
Yeah, and that is really interesting, right? Like, yeah, so Beyonce's Beyonce's song Formation, you know, she performed at the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And it was incredibly controversial, her performance with the dancers dressed as Black Panthers. And I personally have a number of friends who railed against her performance, who mm-hmm. really thought that it was completely inappropriate. But mm-hmm. from her perspective, and I think from a lot of other people's perspective, it was something that needed to be said. It was something that needed to be done. And so mm-hmm. for the artist, there is an opportunity there in amongst all of the discussion and the furor. There's a couple of opportunities there. There's a monetary opportunity, as well as an opportunity to move the discussion in a certain way. And they don't have to be mutually exclusive. Is that what you're saying?
Right. They don't have to be mutually exclusive. And here's where it gets a little bit dicey, right? Because this is, you know, when we talk about things like opportunity and leverage, that's where it can feel dirty. right? And I think that's part of why people feel like it's inappropriate to talk about these kinds of things in that particular setting. And you're almost, you're damned if you do and you don't. You know?
Okay, so I want to pause for just a second.
Yeah,
so, and I want to say, sure. Everybody that's listening, I know that some of you are probably thinking, oh, that's like Jenny just said, oh, that's totally inappropriate to leverage a movement or to leverage something that is emotionally fraught like that to make money. So I would love to hear from you, your thoughts or your questions around how, you know, what do you do with your art that touches onto those hot button issues, and what questions do you have around making money in these areas, and how do you navigate that, and what kind of help do you need to navigate that kind of stuff? So go ahead, Jenny, and finish what you were going to say. You were talking about the tension there.
Oh, yeah. Well, so it's kind of a catch-22, because the thing is this upside-down structure where it's really not a system that's beneficial to the artist, to the maker of the thing, right? And we know that there are big companies that profit off of the music, and we know that there are a lot of big companies that are in control of most of the content that gets created, and what gets to be seen, and that's the hard part of it. But that doesn't change the fact that that the arts are a fundamental platform for talking about the things that we really care about, and they're extremely indicative of the health of the current culture, you know. And so it's just this is where, you know, we do need to have some way to value all of these different types of works. I think one of the comments, on the post was about, you know, what types of works are the ones that sell versus the ones that don't. Is it the safer work that sells? It doesn't necessarily mean that we need to go about it each one in the same way, but we do have to recognize the value and the power of each, and not be shy to take a stand for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's funny because in Murger's book, in the beginning of his book, A Day in the Life of the Bohemian, in the introduction, he actually recognizes that tension, right? He recognizes that.
Yeah.
And there's this great quote where he says that bohemia, the state of being a starving artist, is meant to be a temporary state, and that you have to move on either to the academy, the Hotel Dieu, or the morgue, is what he says.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Hotel Dieu is or was the insane asylum in Paris. Right, it was the mental place where where you went if you went crazy, and of course the morgue is means you die, and the academy was the place where professional artists went, and you became recognized by the academy, became a part of the academy, and then you got to show your work in the academy every year and sell your work in the academy's annual show. So before I interpret that myself, how would you interpret that quote, Jenny?
Oh man. You know what? I think one of the I would say that that I like the fact that he says, you know, this is a temporary state. It isn't just the image of the artist that you're aspiring to be. There is something else for your work. And okay, so you know, you have these choices to either become the artist you're supposed to or die or go crazy. And that's essentially what he's saying. It's like your choices are to become a renowned artist or to die or go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I wish he gave another option, honestly, other than the academy. I do.
The academy is interesting, right? Because that was before the name now escapes me, before the Impressionists, right? The Impressionists came along and broke the Academy's hold on who got to be a professional artist in France, right?
Yeah.
So when Murger was alive, the only way you could be a professional artist was to join the Academy. And I think that those options are different now. You don't have to be recognized by a formal society in order to be a successful, mm-hmm. legitimate artist. And they, what is his name? The Water Lilies artist.
Monet?
Thank you, Monet. I went and toured his grounds last year, and
I can't remember.
Thank you, Brian.
Okay, there's been a lot of,
I've just lost all credibility with my audience. So Monet was a protest artist, in essence, right? Like he made work that was completely different than what everybody else in France was making at the time, and his work was very controversial. And the other artists the other impressionists that were coming up with him were the same. They were all making work that had been resoundingly rejected by the Academy. Mm-hmm. And they found a third way. They put up their own show and they sucked away the audience from the Academy and got another dealer who was willing to take a chance on them, handle some of their business affairs. And they sucked away this audience from the Academy and said, actually, what the Academy says is good art is not all that is good art. And then you see that sort of happen over and over again throughout history, right? You got the Armory Show, mm-hmm. in New York, which was very much the same way. And the Young British Artist Show, with Damien Hirst and all of those folks. Exact same thing. People who couldn't get a show in one of the big galleries or with the establishment, so they went and made their own thing.
They tend to start their own movement. Yeah, they tend to start their own thing. And that's part of the power of something like the Bohemian movement, right? And part of what artists do is break an existing mold, which is maybe part of why I'm a little disappointed the only three options after being a Bohemian are to go crazy, die, or go to the Academy. Mm-hmm. There was a good saying I came across recently that every time we're given a chance to reimagine the future, we build it in the image of the past. Everything that we see, like, it's not new, and it's something maybe where, you know, here we are to bring it back to this topic of art and money. Maybe it's not this either or, where, you know, you either work for passion or you sell out and you commercialize your stuff. Maybe it is in the arts itself. Maybe it's with the artist being educated and being confident about not only money, but the value of things, how we measure value in this society, because money isn't the only measurement, and that's part of the current problem too.
Sure.
But if the arts becomes a way to gauge value, then maybe this is where we have the chance to try different models, try different business models, try different models of success for artists. And it doesn't have to be the lionized image of the artist who starves for his work.
You see as the different business models that artists could possibly take advantage of now? And before you answer that, I want to ask those of you in the audience, what are your questions around money? What are your hangups around money? When you think of the word money, what does that make you feel, and how does it make you feel, and what does it make you think of when I say the word money? And go ahead and type your answers into the questions. And Jenny, I'd love to hear, as you're talking, what are these different business models that you think are possible?
I can't see the list of people actually. So are we waiting?
Yeah, go ahead and go. And I'm reading some of the questions as they come in to see what people are saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. As far as the different models, I think that there's a lot that the arts can learn from what other businesses have done. And so, as an example with how fast distribution is getting, it's scary, right? You know, like Amazon and FedEx just partnered. Good for them. I think that there's a lot more that we can do than just become a distribution and service country. And it's something that I wonder about. So, you know, right now, like one of the big hypes is this sharing economy that we're in. And, you know, our fastest growing companies are companies like Airbnb and Uber that have no... have no formal real estate, right? Who own any cars and maybe doesn't own any taxis. And so one of the things that I wonder is, okay, so here in the arts, a lot of times we are solopreneurs. We're working on our own. And what can we learn about how these other businesses have optimized to speed up distribution? Because that's essentially what their advantage is. They're not the ones, like Amazon's not the one manufacturing. Mm-hmm. They're just distributing it faster. Zappos doesn't make anything. They just deliver it faster. And so, okay, well, what can we learn from those strategies? What can we learn about the power of a network so that we then can be the ones to deliver? And it doesn't necessarily mean faster, but how do we understand then how we structure something around ourselves? Because I think that's where artists usually end up losing out, right? We sell prints online, and when we do that, yeah, we sell them for a markup, but chances are, because we're doing it through a distribution service, the majority of the profit goes to the one distributing the print. Then, you know, as far as our originals, I mean, we seek out gallery representation, and many of us know that even if we get into a reputable gallery, we're still going to be doing a lot of legwork to promote the work. So here we are again. We're losing out on 50% of our profits. And here's a hard one where I don't think that this is going to be an overnight thing, but maybe just like plant a seed to just get people thinking about it. Isn't it curious how in the gallery model, we all provide inventory for free to a gallery and maybe sell it? You know, like no other, like what other business does this? You know, it's a,
well,
yeah, it's,
okay,
it's
so
I'll, any other, yeah, but it's just,
I'll,
it's,
I'll
it's
push
kind
back.
Of, yeah.
I'll push back on that and say it's actually not that uncommon. It's actually not that uncommon. There are a lot of retail businesses where the person who makes the product or the company that makes the product provides that product to the retailer to sell. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't sell, the retailer returns it to the producer.
Right.
That actually happens quite a bit.
That's true.
Yeah. And so when artists realize that it's not that unique of a model, the difference or the challenge for artists, I think, is the fact that for the most part, artists don't seek out having a direct relationship with the end collector or the end buyer, right? That the gallery handles the entire transaction, and the artist never has a relationship. And so then you get into situations where if your gallery goes away, you suddenly have no distribution and no sales, right? I want to back up to you mentioned thinking about companies like Uber and what was the other one? Airbnb, companies that essentially have zero inventory and they make money off of distribution and logistics.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
I think that there are opportunities for artists to do that right now. Right. If Amazon is going to handle distribution, or you've got print on demand providers, of which there are dozens, there is no reason that you as an artist can't divorce your own income from your efforts. Somebody mentioned in here, Brian Turnbow says, I guess the question is, how do we justify the discrepancy between, how does he put this? I'm just trying to make the question more succinct. So it takes me a lot of time to make an original piece of art, right? And I find it difficult to charge enough for that piece of art to make even minimum wage for the amount of time that I put into it, right? So how do I justify the discrepancy when time equals money? And I think that you have to divorce time from money, right? The time that you put into your work doesn't necessarily correlate to some sort of hourly value. That's a mistake that we get into a lot as artists. There's linear inch pricing where you add the length times the width, and then you multiply that result by a dollar or whatever the right amount is for you. And then it's not no longer about how much time you put into the work. It's about the size, and then the multiplier is your value as an artist, right? And that goes up as your work is more in demand. And then you get artists like, I had Cassie Tully on the podcast last year, and she is charging over $10,000 for a painting. She doesn't do linear inch pricing anymore. Her minimum price is $10,000 because there is the demand for her work there. So she can charge that. Mm-hmm. So there are multiple ways that you can divorce the amount of time you put into a piece of art from the value, from the price that you ask for it. And that is by delivering value and creating enough value in the mind of your collectors to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jacobina says, I need a lot of money to express myself. Christy's Fair says, in regards to art, I try to price my work so people can afford it, yet make some money too. So my thing to find the right price so I don't look too cheap and not too expensive. That's what I think about when you say money. I guess pricing is such a hard topic. Pricing is a hard topic. Any response there?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you in terms of the difficulty of pricing with hours in mind. And I mean, charging by the hour is really easy when it's a rote task. It's really hard when it's a creative task. And I think that's, and definitely one of the challenges, I think, for artists today, because so much of our culture is based on justifying the value of something. That's a big question. It's like, well, is art necessary for survival? And, you know, and that kind of thing. So in regards to pricing for artwork, I know there's always that fear of overpricing your work and then potentially, say, losing out on a sale. I think it feels, quite frankly, a lot worse to know that you've underpriced it and then you've maybe made enough to, say, go out three nights and then and you've lost your painting, you know. That's one of the ways that I'll put it too. It's like, you know, you think about why we worry about the affordability of artwork, and part of it is that at some point in time, multiple times, all of us have had that person in the gallery who said, it's like, oh, I would love to have that if only someday I had the money, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing is, you know, that the same person probably has an iPhone, probably has, a monthly subscription to cable and all of these other things. And it's not about affordability as much as it is about value. And so I think artists need to be a little bit less afraid of whether or not their work is affordable. Your work is affordable. I mean, yes, beyond a certain threshold, you're going to take it out of a particular market. So you have to decide, you know, who do you want your customer to be? You might not want the customer who drops $10,000 on a painting. You might not want to be in that market. And that's fine. You know, if the amount of time you put into your work and the value you're able to get out of it, you can charge something that you think is, this is something that I know in standard middle class America, for mm-hmm. instance, is able to afford and is something that I also feel good about. Like, I know that this person spent, say, $700 on this piece. Like, for me, if somebody spends that on a piece, I'm like, you know what? I know that they really value it. I know that they didn't just, like, get away with, like, you know, a deal and that they're just thinking, oh, my God, you know, like, screw this person who doesn't know the value of a work, you know, like that's something where I'm like, yeah, you know, like $700, that is a new smartphone. That is a month's worth of rent for a lot of people. And to know that, yeah, like this is something, like I chose to invest in this piece of work, in this object that its sole purpose in life is to add beauty or to beckon me to look at it and ask questions about what I see around me. Mm-hmm. That's its function, and that's enough. So yeah, it's just that's my two cents as far as affordability value goes.
That's great. So Linda Vero says, I used to hang up around money for years, and then a shift happened for me when I recognized that money is energy, and I can let it flow through me and back to me and be attracted to me. I stopped blocking it, and things began to change positively. That's awesome. Charlie George says, I don't want money to be the measure of my ability. On the other hand, I want my art to be appreciated by those around me. Mm-hmm. And of course, money is a surrogate for appreciation. This is so great. And something that just popped into my head, artist Jolie Guillebeau, who we've had on the podcast before, you were talking about maybe you don't want to be the artist who sells paintings for $10,000. Jolie, I think, mm-hmm. is a great model for this. When she started selling her work 5 or 6 years ago, Jolie created her first series of work, which was 100 pieces. And she told all of her mm-hmm. friends and family that she was going to create this new series of work and that she would email everybody, all of her friends, she would email everybody on her mailing list each day as she had new pieces done. And so she was sending out emails 3 to 5 days a week as she completed new pieces. And she started out charging $1 for the first piece, $2 for the second piece, $3 for the third piece, and so on, until she got up to $100 for the piece on the 100th day. And she sold every single piece except for like two. And they weren't, you know, number 99 and 100. They were somewhere in the middle. And now she sells for more than that, and she tends to sort of grow her prices as her series go along. But that's really interesting to me, the idea that you, and she's made quite a bit of money selling her art that way, selling yeah. small pieces that artists can do with not a lot of difficulty, that mm-hmm. still give her an opportunity to explore and sketch and try different things. And making money that way. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, that is. You know, it reminds me of something else that I came across recently, and it's starting in Minnesota. They're using the CSA model. Are you familiar with the mm-hmm. CSA code?
But maybe explain it. Yeah, explain CSAs for those who aren't familiar. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. So basically, if you're part of a CSA coalition, you've agreed to buy shares of these farmers' crops. And so every week you get delivery of crops. And based on whatever share you buy, that determines how much produce you get from your local farmers. So basically what some folks in Minnesota have done, some organizations there, they've taken that model for the arts. And I haven't read a lot about it yet, but I'm in conversation with some people here in Madison thinking, is this viable for artists, because essentially the idea is that you can have people subscribe to regularly collect art, and mm-hmm. based on their share, say they spend $25, they get one piece a month. They spend $50, they get two pieces a month, and it could be, you know, something like with me, my background is printmaking. This would be something that's very translatable. Somebody can get an original and affordable piece of art on a regular basis.
That's Patreon. And that's the Patreon model.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's also in line with the print on demand idea, right? Where you're making something where you know that it's that you have this guaranteed sale. And I think a lot of times as artists, you know, we go through these phases, right? We go on this like making binge, and it's just like this like huge like amount of making like all at once, and then suddenly we have like 100 pieces mm-hmm. and oh crap.
Yeah, that's funny.
And so I thought that this is a different approach to it, and it's something that we're now seeing with the CSA coalitions for farmers, and then and it's in line with what we see happen with distribution companies and why they are able to be lean and fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Sandra, this is a really good question from Sandra, and this is something that hits really close to home for me, because I felt the same way that Sandra feels for a long time. She says, thinking about money for me seems more like a left-brained exercise. Number crunching and formulating business plans are difficult for me. I also think I have a lot of baggage when it comes to money, a poverty spirit rather than a spirit of abundance, a feeling like living on the edge of my finances is more righteous than chasing the capitalist American dream. I'm trying to learn how to view money in a healthy way, even in a playful, carefree way, but it's not easy. Do you have suggestions to create a healthy mindset that helps the artist to reach for abundant goals? So this is something that I definitely grew up with. I definitely grew up with this kind of relationship with money. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Jenny.
Yeah, I think you're right, and definitely I can speak to that as well. And Yeah, that's not an easy thing to overcome, because the thing is, whatever you grow up experiencing, it's what you're used to. It's what's familiar. I mean, this is why we perpetuate patterns, right? And I think about that too. You know, for me, I grew up in an immigrant family, and there was always this idea that that you know what you have is something that somebody before you had to really struggle for, and always that reminder of, you know, like I've it's just that there's that closeness to how hard life is. And so when it isn't that hard anymore, you almost feel like you don't deserve it. And I think that there are a lot of artists who feel this way, that like once they get a little bit of success, they don't deserve it. And then they'll self-sabotage, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Especially if you've been around, you've been in the performing arts too. Like if you're surrounded by other people who are struggling, and suddenly you're not struggling, that's really hard to reconcile.
It becomes weird, right? Like your conversations with other people change. Like if you get a little bit of money, and all of your social circle is people who don't have money, it creates a little bit of a guilt feeling, where other people that I'm talking to, they're talking about struggling with money, they're talking about trying to figure out how to pay their rent, and and I'm over here with my friends, and maybe we're talking about like where we're going to go out to eat that night, or what cool restaurant we're going to try out. And those are very different conversations. And it took me a while to let go of the guilt that comes from that. Yeah. And Sandra said there was this thing in here that she, so there's a few things in here, like feeling like living on the edge of finances is more righteous than chasing the capitalist American dream.
Yeah. I think maybe, okay, as far as like how, because she also asked like how do we move past this, right? How do we change this? And that's a part of our conversation too, is how we change this mindset. I don't think you have to chase the capitalistic dream to find financial stability, you know, and maybe one of the ways that I viewed it, so going back to, do you have to create work that sells easily? Well, it depends who you're trying to sell it to. And part of why you do want to stay true to the type of work that you make, whether that's landscapes, outdoor work, still lifes, or whether that's protest art, whether it's controversial stuff, the big reason you need to stay true to that is because your art is the easiest way that people can find out what you're about, right? And that's actually how you find your crowd, right? And then just anybody who's ever struggled to share their message or share their beliefs, that's the moment that you do, you suddenly realize, oh, you know, you're not alone, and you're not the only one who has this opinion, and it's not actually that scary. It's not actually that bad. And so I'd say that's a part of getting over some of that guilt, getting over some of that struggle, and knowing that when you're okay with getting your message out there in a successful way, it means that you're getting this message to the people who want it, and also to the ones who need it.
So Sandra, before we move on, I'll recommend a couple of books that I really loved around money mindset. One is called Think and Grow Rich. It's by a guy named Napoleon Hill, and Napoleon was a college student about 80 years ago, and he was trying to figure out, he's trying to figure out how to make some money to pay for college. And he decided that he would go interview one of the Rockefellers and write a book about the interview. And he went in there and he did the interview, and he actually got invited back to Rockefeller's house, and they did a 3-day interview where he stayed at his house and learned all about him and got to write this great piece. And at the end, Rockefeller said, I'm going to write you letters of introduction to all of my friends, all of the most powerful men in the world, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, all these amazing people. And I don't want you to write the book about me. I want you to write it about all of us. And so Napoleon Hill then spent the next 20, 30 years of his life working for all of these very powerful, very influential men. And the book Think and Grow Rich is his distillation of what he saw these powerful people, successful people doing. So for me, that book was very powerful. And then another book that I like a lot is called The Power of Possibility. Power of Possibility. And I've actually just been listening to it on Audible. And the book really addresses head on some of the myths that we have about how our mind works and how our brain works. And one of my favorite stories is there was some study done where they were examining people who had, and I can't remember the name of the type of injury, but it's an injury where the left and right sides of your brain become a little bit disconnected. And so they were doing the study with somebody, and they told the right, and I don't know how they did this, electrodes or something. They told the person's, the right side of the person's brain to shut a door, and the left side of his brain made up a story that said that he felt a breeze and that's why he shut the door. Like, the brain is this crazy instrument and we don't really understand how it works at all. And so our relationship with money is because of these deeply held scripts that happen inside of our subconscious that tell our conscious mind how to act and what to do. The Art of Possibility is by Benjamin Zander and Rosamund Zander. Ben is a conductor, a classical music conductor, and he conducts the London Philharmonic. And Rosamund is a social worker and a therapist. Really great book. Two great books to tackle your money mindset.
Those are good recommendations.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, maybe a good note on that is, but you're a voracious reader. There are a lot of good books out there. Mm-hmm. And not only, like what you said, Art of Possibility, it's in this whole vein of books, like Predictably Irrational is another one of them, mm-hmm. That talks about just all the ways in which we think our mind works and then it works in another way. And it gets into our relationship with money as well. So that's a good one. And I think also when you read these things, the books themselves will shift your mindsets. And in that process, make you think, man, I'm really glad that this person succeeded in getting their work out there so that I could see this. Yep. Isn't that a good lesson for us to take away as furnace?
Yeah. Oh, so here's a great thought from Iris. She says, the problem I see is the connection between the monetary worth and the artistic value of the art. Like in the case of the young British artist, since Saatchi bought the artwork, it became valuable, right? So there's a couple things going on there. Charles Saatchi came along and bought Damien Hirst's Death in the Mind, The Impossibility of Death in the Mind of whatever. It's the shark piece, mm-hmm. right? It's the $12 million stuffed shark in a tank of formaldehyde.
$10 million potato picture, but
right, like, it's this art. It's the idea that this art that is something that literally anybody with a small number of resources could do, right? It doesn't take a lot of technical skill, to do those sorts of things. So why is it worth so much? And it's all about branding, right? It's all about perception. It's about the value of somebody else attaching value to it.
It's about branding. It's about, quite frankly, at that point, stocks. I mean, our art on that level, it's not the art anymore, right? There, people, like I hear it all the time where people talk about, like, you know, what a joke, like these guys are like emperors without their clothes on, being spending $10 million on a picture of potato. It's like, they don't care what it looks like. It's mm-hmm. it's an investment at that point. And I think that's maybe one of the challenges for us as artists is a lot of times, you know, the artist, we see this especially in music, the artist is the one who gets vilified and just, you know, like just set on fire in front of everybody for, you know, for selling out or for lip syncing, for faking something, and like they were the ones, they were the puppeteer, like they were the ones controlling the strings for why this happened, And I mean, it's, you know, you think about why art becomes more valuable when an artist dies. At that point, anyone who owns a big collection of their work, of course you're going to push for the value of the work. At that point, it sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard thing to ignore because it's something that just, you know, it indicates the health of our economy. It also indicates how upside down things are and how hard it is to make it as an artist. And I don't know, it's like we kind of have to do a, we have to balance being aware of it, aware enough of it so we know why it is, so we're not, I guess, so upset by it. You know, it's not
sure.
Because this is a great piece of work, but also ignorant of it enough so that we can create our own little corner where we can be successful in the arts. Like, you know what, like, you know, is that, I mean, I don't know, I think it's really easy to almost even be jealous, like, for some artists, like, you know, they're not talented, why did they get that, and, you know, like, it's because of branding, it's because of the right person.
I want to write a blog post. I want to write a blog post about why artists whose work sucks sells more than yours does.
Yeah.
Because I get that question almost every single day. I get that question. Like people will, like, artists that we feature on The Abundant Artist, whether we have them on the podcast or feature them in the blog or whatever.
Yeah.
Every time I put one of them out, mm-hmm. somebody emails me and says, that artist's work sucks. I can't believe you featured them on the blog. And it doesn't matter if they're an illustrator or a fine artist or a sculptor or whatever. I always get an email saying that artist's work sucks and they're just a sellout hack. Or whatever, right? Like something like that. Iris, there's a couple of books that I want to recommend to you that I think are great. One is called The $12 Million Stuffed Shark. And it's a story. It's the story of how Damien Hirst sold that piece to Charles Saatchi. He starts with that story, but then he goes back into the how the whole art market works at that level. From the individual mm-hmm. collectors like Saatchi all the way up to the auction houses and the high-end galleries that pump these artists up and make them into these stocks and turn them into brands mm-hmm. Where it's all about how much money can they get people to pay for the art rather than the artistic merit of the work itself. And once you read that book and sort of see how that world works and that it's all just made up, it's literally just a handful of art dealers just making up a value for the work and then telling everybody, all these people who have more money than sense, telling all of them, if you buy this, it's going to go up in value because we say so. And it's all just
Does
made
everybody
up.
Remember what happened to Beanie Babies?
Right.
Just I'm going to put that out there.
Yeah,
right?
It's the same thing. It's the same thing.
And it's that same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if that's true, if it's all made up, if Charles Saatchi and the art galleries and the art auction houses, if they can just make up prices for these pieces of work, then you can do the same thing. There's nothing stopping you from doing the exact same thing. And so I look at artists like Ashley Longshore. She's an independent artist based in New York. She doesn't show with any galleries. She's got celebrities collecting her work all over the world. She sells pieces for $80,000. She'll drop an Instagram photo of one of her works that she's working on in her studio and sell it for $5,000 off of Instagram. Like, she just decided that her work is worth that much and went and got a couple of celebrities to pay for it. And now her work is magically worth that much. And she didn't ask anybody's permission. She just went and did it.
Yeah, that's you made about that. I mean, you know, like you'd mentioned in one of your emails, just like the artist mindset about money and the mindset around money in other professions, and that's the thing. Everybody's making it up, just quite frankly. you work in any industry, everyone's making it up.
And
I don't know the thing. Yeah, this isn't quite the time or the setting to. And, you know, whether or not we all should be making it up, but just as far as, okay, so then with that in mind, for for this topic, when it's asked, you know, like, well, how did that person get worth that much, or, you know, like, that works and all that, you know, it's a completely different game at that point.
Right.
And maybe, I don't know, maybe to get back to the Bohemians, you know, we are ultimately here because of passion. Yes, we need to eat. Yes, we need our work to be valued. But I guess, yeah, before getting outraged about any of these other things that should be another way, before getting into what is fair, what isn't fair, remembering that, you know, there are some games out there that maybe you don't even want to begin to play them. And,
sure.
And it is about the work at the end of the day. And yeah, you do need to value it. Yeah, you do need to decide this is what this is worth, and you need to be able to command that, and you need to believe that in order for other people to believe that. And I guess we're needing, you know, just for each of us, we need to know where to draw that line individually for whom we want to do business with, whom we want our customers to be, where we want our work to be, how either in a family's home or in rich storage cases for eternity with the rest of the socks, you know. What is your goal with this?
What do you
work?
Want your
and
life
then,
to be like? What do you want your? How do you want your work?
What do you
to
want
be
your
seen?
Life to be?
Yeah.
Right, and then how do you make that viable? And just finding how to bridge that gap.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So as we're winding up on 7 o'clock here, I want to wind up for a second, and I want to highlight, I've been waiting to address this thing from Regina. She says, it's either Regina or Regina. Depending on which part of the world you're in. Regina says, is there any marketing strategies that could be suggested? Thanks. So Regina, yes, absolutely. We could talk about marketing strategies. So you're already registered for this webinar. Next week, Tuesday and Thursday, we're going to hold two other webinars. On Tuesday, we're going to talk about leadership. Another word for leadership is branding. So we're going to talk about leadership next Tuesday, and what it means to take leadership in your community. And then on Thursday, we're going to talk about some practical applications for what we've talked about here, around pricing and mindset. And what we're going to talk about on Thursday, we're going to talk about practical applications on how to actually make all of this theory and all of this discussion work for you. So I want to thank Jenny for being here. Jenny, if anybody wanted to see your work or follow up with you, where would they do that?
Okay, yeah. My website is jenie.org. So simple and sweet. And then my email address is the word here, here, at Jenny, jenie.org. And I would be really happy to hear from you to continue this discussion. Thank you also, Corey, for having me on this webcast today. And I've really enjoyed this discussion and looking forward to more like it.
Awesome. So, yeah, thank you so much. And like I said, we're going to have the next two webinars next week. This coming summer, July 2016, we're also holding a conference for artists. It's going to be what I think is the first of its kind, a business conference for artists. There's a lot of business conferences out there. Most of them don't address the specific needs of artists. There's a lot of artist conferences out there that mostly just talk about how to make better art. This is going to be a business conference for artists where we have successful artists from all over North America talking about how they got to where they are and how you can do the same. So that's July 1st and 2nd of 2016. And you can find out more about it and sign up at abundantartistconference.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week for the next session. Thanks so much, everybody.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Corey.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.